Thank you. Please be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Honda versus Walmart.
Presenting the court with two strong issues today, one dealing with statutory construction, one dealing with choice of law. And although we said in our brief that the court should address the rendition issue first, I have some problem with the logic of that. The rendition issue is the statutory construction issue. The remand issue is the choice of law issue. Here's my problem. The statutory construction issue is whether the Court of Appeals erred in interpreting the Texas statute. I think before we get to that question, we've got to determine whether the case was properly decided under Texas law. So it appears to me that logically, the choice of law issue needs to be addressed first to determine whether we're under Texas or Mexican law. If we're under Mexican law...
Why did you not waive that by moving for entry of the judgment on the bar?
Well, the argument is based on a case called Fodgetick. And that case is a case in which they moved for judgment and then tried to challenge the factual sufficiency of the jury findings on appeal. The court said you can't do that because that's an inconsistent form of relief. In this case, we had preserved our right to have this under Mexican law three different ways. We filed a motion to apply Mexican law. That was denied. We filed a renewal of our motion to apply Mexican law after Leon James and Brownsville Sports Center were dismissed from the case at the close of plaintiff's evidence. We filed an objection to the charge. All of which preserved error. Now, the reason that the Fodgetick line of cases doesn't apply is because that's not an inconsistent form of relief. We're asking for an alternative form of relief. We're saying that the case was improperly rendered under Texas law. There's no inconsistency because the case was improperly decided because either it was improperly decided under Texas law or it should have been brought under Mexican law. Either way, the result would have been the same.
But if we decide you're right, that this case should be decided under Mexican law.
Correct.
And that you didn't waive error on that, then don't we still have it? There's no cross petition or cross point from the plaintiffs below, respondents here, that they want another trial under Mexican law, but we still have to look at your rendition point, or why not?
Well,
it would certainly make the case easier for us if we didn't.
We've asked the court for a remand under Mexican law, and I think that that's the proper result. I mean, I don't think you can render it under Mexican law. I think if you determine that Mexican law was applied, that the only remedy...
If the law of Mexico does apply, then you withdraw your request for a rendition under Texas law, since it never should have applied in the first place.
I think we have to. Correct. Now, let me address, if I can address your concerns with the waiver argument. The other issue is that Fodgetick dealt with factual sufficiency challenge, and this, of course, is a legal challenge. And this court has held that you can preserve legal challenges in a whole bunch of different ways, not the least of which is having three different times when the judge was specifically presented with a request for a ruling and denied. So we feel that we certainly preserve error on the choice of law issue. Now, with regard to choice of law, we think the facts are simple. This is a suit brought by a Mexican parent for the death of a 10-year-old boy who was a Mexican national. The death occurred in Mexico, caused by a product that was purchased in Mexico and the negligence of his parents, which occurred in Mexico. The only fact that ties this case to Texas is that the product was once sold in Texas 9 years before it was purchased, used in Mexico by the Mexican parent. That's the only fact. Now, they have raised in their reply brief a lot of facts that cannot be considered. And those facts are, for example, this consent decree stuff. That evidence was excluded by the trial court. It cannot be considered. They raised the fact that, well, Mr. Ramos went to the Brownsville dealership. You notice in the brief that they've submitted, they say he went to the Brownsville dealership and that he didn't get the proper warnings. But if you'll notice, there's no cite to the record on any of those statements that they make in their brief. The reason for that is all of those things were excluded also. The testimony...
You can see that BMS, that the Brownsville dealer was Honda's agent. BSC was Honda's agent for the purpose of passing on the warnings.
Not under the theory that they're arguing. They argued that they were required to pass on warnings because of the consent decree. The consent decree, by its very terms, and this is in the record at page 928 in the clerk's record, the consent decree did not even apply to dealers. So the dealer was under no obligation to convey any warnings at all. The second part of that equation is that at the time Mr. Ramos went into the store, which is 1989, they didn't even have ATVs. The ATVs were removed, and this is undisputed in the record, the ATVs were removed in 1987. He wasn't even selling three-wheeled ATVs at the time Mr. Ramos went in the store. And there's certainly no duty in Texas, no post-sale duty, to warn casual browsers of anything. You have a situation where he goes into the store, he states, kind of vague in the record what happened in the store. He states that he didn't ask questions the first time, the second time he went in there and asked some questions. But there's nothing in the record that says that he was a customer of theirs, that he bought anything there. There's no duty to warn casual browsers in Texas. So in answer to your question, I don't believe that that's relevant.
One of the conditions that is identified in determining choice of law questions is the economic risk that may be suffered by a resident defendant. Why wouldn't Texas be interested in resident defendants' economic concern to the extent that they wouldn't want people, you know, in other countries that may have very liberal damages laws to be making their law applying to defendants over here when we have businesses that export their products around the world? Why wouldn't that be a significant factor for having this case tried in Texas, as we're under Texas, the most significant context on what law applies here as opposed to Mexican law?
Sure. I think Texas does have an interest in protecting resident defendants. And Texas does have an interest in providing remedies for its citizens. We don't have any resident defendants or any Texas citizens in this case. Honda doesn't have any factories here. Of course, it has some dealerships here, but this court has held that just the mere idea of stream of commerce, the fact that they participated in the stream of commerce, is not enough on itself to justify jurisdiction. It's certainly not enough as a single factor to justify application of Texas law. You also have the case of Larchmont versus Para, in which the court said there may be some equitable things that we should decide. There may be some public policy things that we could decide that maybe it would be more equitable to have Texas law apply than another law apply. But the court said in that case, we can't use the public policy doctrine to determine choice of law. We can't determine if it would be more equitable somewhere else. All we have to determine is which law applies. And in this case, it's very clear which law should apply. The stream of commerce analysis that the court of appeals used misconstrued the balancing that needs to be done in a choice of law analysis. The analytical framework that they used is that because it once entered the stream of commerce, then Texas law attaches to that product permanently, no matter where that product travels, no matter what country it causes an injury. And that can't be the law. And it's not the proper law, it's not the proper analysis. It's a weighing. The determination is, where is the most significant relationship?
On that question, are we looking at the, are we supposed to be looking at the conduct of the parties, or are we looking at the product itself, the product liability action? Where should our focus be?
Well, I think you look at both. It's not only product liability action, but it's also a negligence action alleged against the parents. You look at the product, and you look at the product in terms of what was done with the product. Their allegations are marketing and design defect. And you can look at where the product goes and where the product was designed and manufactured, which was Japan. But you also look at where the relationship of the parties was. And they admitted that the relationship of the parties focused in Mexico. And therefore, the relationship of the parties, even to this product, was in Mexico because they bought the product in Mexico.
Is the choice of law decision that we now have to make? First of all, apparently there's no discretion in the trial court. It's a legal call.
Correct.
So in looking at this, does the fact that the jury put 33 1/3% on each parent make choice of law any different than it would have been if they put zero on everybody but Hunter?
Sure.
It does. So the trial court has to guess in a vacuum and then we reverse it in 2020 hindsight?
No, I think it's a different analysis. The trial court has to make a judgment of law, and he was given that opportunity several times even before the case went to the jury. And he, in sending it to the jury, determined that there was some evidence of the parents' negligence. So I think that, you know, he had also had that question posed to him. But this court, at least under the Surgitech versus Able case, when you're doing a de novo, and that's not mentioned in our briefs, it's a case that Justice Enoch. When you're doing a de novo review, you look at the entire record. And so this is a question of law that's subject to a de novo review. You look at the entire record, and looking at the entire record, you have one fact that connects this with Texas, and that's it. That's the stream of commerce.
So repeating my question, our review, choice of law, is affected by the amount of contributory responsibility that the jury put on the parents.
I think so. I think that because you look at the entire record, you're kind of retrying the issue, and you have the benefit that the trial court didn't have of having the entire record. But couldn't
that mean that the determination would be different depending at what point in time during the trial court made the decision, so that it could be one decision on choice of law before the case went to the jury and a different choice afterwards? How would that work? Surely that can't be the case.
Well, I don't think it is the case. I think that what we're focusing on is the decision that was made by the trial court before the case was submitted to the jury. We're not asking this court to go back and reanalyze it based on what he should have done after the case was already submitted to the jury. I think that the proper analysis is the time before the case was sent to the jury. That's when the trial court could have done something.
Well, wouldn't the fact, though, that the parents' conduct was an issue at all in the case impact the analysis regardless of what the jury decided?
Sure. And as I said, the judge had to determine that there's some evidence to submit their negligence in the first place, so their negligence certainly played a part, or should have played a part, in his analysis. Let me turn to the statutory construction issue. And the statutory construction issue, as you know, is whether it's a simple question. Are the parents separate claimants under 330.0111, or are they a single claimant? If they're a single claimant, then their negligence should have been combined. And if it's combined, then they're barred from recovery as a trial court found.
Mr. Hummel, let me ask you a procedural question before you get too far into that. I understand from your briefing that you take the position that the parents should be viewed as a unit because their conduct was unitary. If that's the case, then why was it submitted to the jury in a way in which each parent was treated as an individual and their individual conduct was judged by the jury?
I think that's a misnomer. They weren't really submitted as separate claimants because it's the pattern jury charge, and the case law has said that under 71.1.2 of the pattern jury charge, if you're going to submit them as separate claimants, you submit separate issues.
I understand, but they each had their name under the issue, right. And they each had a blank by them. So the jury considered, as they worked
through the issue, each parent individually, and assess the percentage of responsibility to each one of them. And so my problem is it seems a little bit inconsistent to me, separate and apart from the statutory construction argument, to look at a jury charge that was submitted in this way and then try after the fact to say we put them together. It would seem to me they would have needed to have been submitted together if we were asking the jury to judge their conduct as a unit.
I see my time has expired. May I respond?
Yes, please.
We're not complaining if there's any defect in the way it's submitted. We're complaining that it should have been submitted that way because the pattern jury charge says when there's multiple plaintiffs and they're going to be aggregated together, you submit them as one unit. If their argument is correct that it should have been submitted as one whole unit, then not only the parents but the deceased should have been submitted as one whole unit. There's no precedent for that, and there was no harm to us because we're not complaining about the way it was submitted. We're saying
well,
that the
court... I understand you're not complaining about the way it was submitted. I'm just saying that it seems to me that your argument challenging after the fact is inconsistent with the way it was submitted to the jury.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that what we're saying is that the Court of Appeals misapplied the law to the charge as submitted, and the misapplication of law was based on this court's construction of Chapter 33011. It's the same as if the court after the fact applied settlement credits or decided an election between damage remedies.
But if your interpretation of the statute is correct, then shouldn't the jury charge be submitted differently in the future?
I think that's certainly a call that this court can make, but I think there's no harm in submitting it that way at
Here's
all.
Here's my problem with really both sides on this. Despite all your talk about dialects and such, you both admit in your briefs that there's some factual intensiveness to this. If the parents are separated and they're living in different countries, and one of them's totally responsible and the other one isn't, that's a different situation than if they're both standing there jointly participating in the conduct that's alleged to be negligent. And given that situation, it seems to me that you have to do something in this submission to alert the trial judge which way you, which paradigm your version of the facts would make this fall into. Of course, it's a confusing area. It's still a relatively new area in Texas law, but the trial judge wasn't really tipped off by either the submissions or the objections as to who thought who should be aggregated and who shouldn't be.
But if there were separate duties, as if you have the woman in Nebraska and the husband in Houston that tells the kid to go play on the track, if you have separate duties, then they should have submitted separate arguments. The irony of it, separate issues. The irony of this is that when they went up to the Court of Appeals and they tried to argue that they should be considered separately, Honda's argument was that they should have submitted them separately and that they had waived their argument because they failed to submit it separately. Now that we get to the Supreme Court...
I don't understand what you mean by submitting it separately. Why isn't a separate submission with separate blanks for each parent? I'm missing something.
They're arguing that they should be treated like two different plaintiffs that had no relation to each other. If I have two different plaintiffs that are in an automobile, they're a three-car automobile accident, then they have two separate submissions, one versus Honda, one versus Honda. And we argued that they should have submitted that way and that they waived it. Now in the Supreme Court, for the first time, they're arguing that we should have submitted it another way and that we waived it. But of course, that argument's waived because it was never raised in the Court of Appeals.
You know, so we're on waiver, one final question. How come you didn't wait too long to... initiate the appeal in the Court of Appeals after the trial judge finally decided who was really still in the case?
We filed it within 45 days of the last ruling on the motion for a hearing.
But we're supposed to take motions as to what their content is rather than just their caption.
Well, let me
explain.
And
that was not a motion for a hearing, top side and their bottom. Why should we take the caption?
Let me explain why it was. Brownsville and Leon James were parties to the appeal. They say in the briefs that they weren't parties to the appeal, but they were parties to the appeal, and the reason that they were parties to the appeal is they were challenging the dismissal against them. So the Court of Appeals came down and entered this ruling against Honda, and in its final ruling, it said Brownsville Sports Center and Leon James are liable to pay costs. Brownsville and Leon James then filed a motion for a hearing and said, we're not liable to pay costs. You held against us and filed an argument to that. The plaintiffs agreed to that and submitted an thing saying that they didn't oppose it, and the Court of Appeals corrected the judgment. The petition for review was filed within 45 days of that order.
I have one other question. On your brief on page 19, you say the case does not involve an effort to impute or otherwise attribute the liability of one spouse to another spouse.
Correct.
Not dealing with an innocent spouse situation. If we were, would the result be different? And how and why?
I don't think so. And the reason that I don't think so, and I've wrestled with this issue myself, because you know you want to think out this whole argument. You have a wife in Nebraska that has nothing to do with it. Why should the husband's negligence bar her recovery? And I think the reason is because that's a policy determination that was made by the legislature. The legislature decided we want all derivative claimants to be single claimant. And if their combined negligence exceeds 60%, then they can't be covered. There's no contention here that the language of the statute is ambiguous at all. Because there's no contention of language ambiguous, this court doesn't get to policy. This court has to take these statutes as they find them. And since this court has already written twice that this definition of claimant includes all the people that are seeking recovery, then I think this court doesn't get into those kind of policy issues. This court merely has to apply the statute. Now, is it fair? I don't know. Certainly she would have a recovery against the father. To be able to sue the father, there's all kinds of cases in Texas where another beneficiary, wrongful death beneficiary, sued another wrongful death beneficiary for wrongful death. She would have a recovery against the most negligent person, so she's not left without a remedy. But is it fair or just? Is it good policy? It's probably good policy in this case because we have parents that are equally liable for violation of a joint duty.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the sponsor.
Mr. Grillo, do you agree that the choice of law question should be decided by the court first?
I think the change, how the case comes out, that's correct.
But do you think that in order of decision that it should be the first issue decided?
That's fine, Your Honor. If the case is decided based on Mexican law, it would not likely be retried in light of the expense involved versus the damages you might recover. Again, Kevin Grillo and Robert Hilliard, who's the trial counsel in this case, on behalf of the respondents, Mr. and Mrs. Ramos. There are two issues, and let me address those two issues as respondents see it. The first one, as to the jury verdict issue, there is no authority in Texas for this court to combine separately submitted wrongful death plaintiffs after verdict to see if the statutory bar is equal.
Would you mind addressing the choice of law question first, since we've all agreed that it needs to be, and I would hate for you to get to the end of your time and not have addressed it.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The point brought up by Mr. Holman, and I think the court addressed, was what does the court consider? One of the issues Mr. Holman referenced was, what about the consent decree? The trial court excluded it at trial. But the problem is, that's not the way the analysis for choice of law is done. The choice of law analysis is done by the evidence relevant to that issue brought before the trial court. The choice of law issue was decided first by Honda filing their motion, their exhibits, and the respondent filing their response and their exhibits. Specifically in those exhibits was the Consumer Product Safety Commission consent decree. It was relevant to the choice of law issues because what Honda agreed to do in that decree. Specifically, it agreed to use its best efforts to ensure its dealer communicated the warnings required to be communicated to any prospective customer of a Honda dealer. And if you listen to the words best efforts, it doesn't sound very strong. But if you look at the specific language in the consent decree, it states best efforts, in fact, includes a duty and obligation on behalf of Honda to insert a provision into their contract with their dealer to ensure the decree is complied with. We offered into evidence, as part of that response to the motion, the contracts that were signed by Honda and Brown Schwartzen.
How if we were to consider the consent decree and the contract, how do those facts balance against the factors that are part of the most significant relationship test, since it is a balancing?
Well, I'd start off by citing as authority the September 25th docket. There's a statement down here that says, before buying a used ATV, the father inquired about ATVs at the Brownsville dealership. There are no product liability choice of law cases that have these type of facts. The fact that the person who ultimately purchased the vehicle that killed his son went to the very dealer that sold it. And he went to that dealer, although he was a prospective customer, and he may have been window shopping. Unique to this case, that prior to him going in there, Honda already agreed that they have to contractually require their dealer to run it.
How does that balance against the other facts that Mr. Holman has mentioned, and in particular the fact that the injury occurred in Mexico?
That's one of those four factors under Section 145.
And one that is to be given significant attention.
I disagree with that one.
Okay, why?
In 1979, this court adopted the most significant relationship test in Gutierrez. That test itself doesn't provide emphasis to any fact. In fact, Gutierrez specifically says it's not the number of contacts, it's the quality, and no one specific factor is to be given more emphasis than any other.
And so that's my question. You're relying on the Brownsville dealership and the consent decree. How would you weigh that? How would you write the opinion weighing those facts against the facts that Mr. Holman has listed as in his argument, where he says the test weighs in favor of Mexico as the choice of law? Do the balancing for us. What does the opinion look like?
Well, the balancing has to look at those four factors. The conduct concerned in this case, as all cases addressing product liability choice of law cases say, is the product. Not one case says you look at contributory negligence. Not one case says you look at what the jury says. They all say you look at the product. And there's three facets of looking at the product. Design, manufacture, and stream of commerce. Obviously, design and manufacture aren't concerned with Texas or Mexico. Stream of commerce is where this first sale, this product occurred down in Brownsville. In addition, unique to this case is that Mr. Ramos, down in the Brownsville, Matamoros area, crossed the border and went over to the only Honda dealer in that entire area. Mr. James, who is the owner of Honda, testified that the primary area of responsibility is Matamoros and Brownsville. So it's extremely reasonable and foreseeable that he's going to go over and go to the only Honda dealer to get that information. He went there on two occasions. We specifically pled in plaintiff's pleadings that there was a failure to warn of the not buying this vehicle for his 8-year-old son. And there were two failures to warn. He testified that if he had gotten that information, he wouldn't have purchased the product. The other factors there is there are no Mexican defendant involved. If you're going to apply the choice of law and be concerned with the limitations in the liability section or the damage section of Mexican law, all the cases are consistent is that you look what the reason behind that is. The reason behind those limitations is to protect Mexican defendants. There are no Mexican defendants. This court in Duncan v. Sesta made a specific point that there's no party to be affected by the specific conduct you're concerned with, then that state would not have an interest in it.
But you'd agree that Mexico is the place with the most direct interest in the plaintiff's monetary recovery.
I would agree it is a interest. I think if you look at this court's analysis in Torrington,
what interest would any other state have in the plaintiff's recovery here?
The interest in Texas is that we have a products liability system designed to deter defective products being sold in Texas.
No. Plaintiff's monetary recovery.
And let me continue. The system is designed to deter defective products being sold in the state of Texas. If you have a system which says, okay, we're going to find you liable, but we're going to award you nominal damages, which is what this is going to be if it exceeds just the expenses in the case, then you have no deterrence. So you've eliminated that issue. And in fact, I think the interest in having a person from your state being compensated is to make sure they get adequate compensation. There can be no concern that they get more compensation. It's to ensure they get at least the compensation that forum state requests. There's a specific case that wasn't cited in this brief, but out of Colorado.
Let's assume you're correct about our products liability interest. That may not be Mexico's products liability interest, or any other country's products liability interest. It's one thing if there's a direct sale and the individual then takes the property with him or herself and goes elsewhere. That's one issue. But once these products are in, they've been sold, they're out there, I would assume in Canada and in Mexico, there are lots of American-made products sold in the United States that get moved over there. Does Canada really expect American products liability law to apply to their citizens' relationship to that product they're driving on their street? And that, it seems to me that plays, that's a fairly significant consideration here, and not simply just American, the United States' interest in products liability.
I certainly think that's a factor to consider, Your Honor. It's just not one factor, but that's why the statement suggests that you consider the interest of the foreign states. That's why you go back to this analysis, design, manufacture, and stream of commerce. Obviously, by the time it gets to Canada, it's been sold in Texas and got resold in Georgia, that argument loses any weight. Of course, Canada's going to have an interest in it, but the same analysis also exists. Is there a Canadian defendant? If there was a Canadian defendant that sold the product, then it would be more likely you'd want to apply Canadian law because they're going to be affected by the liability scheme and the damage scheme of Canada.
But I assume Canada's strongest interest is in its own citizens' health and welfare and safety. Wouldn't that be the strongest interest of any country or not?
I think it's a interest. I think when you start saying the strongest interest, that's not how the analysis is done in the most significant relationship test. You look at the context and you evaluate them through all the facts. We can't isolate and just say there's one fact. I mean, there's no question. We can always say it's always the place of injury. That used to be the law before 1979. We eliminated that consideration. Now we say we have to look at all the facts. It may be if it was sold in Texas, it was designed in Georgia, there may be some other considerations. That is one factor. It's not the definitive factor.
Didn't we also say in Wagner Brown that you have to divide it up on an issue-by-issue basis? And so perhaps the argument you just made about products liability concerns would govern the liability question. But in terms of the damages question and how you calculate and allocate damages, again, I keep coming back to the Tarrington language that talks about the particular plaintiff's recovery. And you'd agree that there's no interest in protecting the defendant against financial hardship in Texas because it's a Japanese company. So that there's no interest there.
There was a Texas defendant, so I'm not sure.
But that's not who we're dealing with here. We're dealing with Honda.
There's no interest in
protecting Honda because it's not against financial. Texas has no interest in protecting Honda from financial hardship in this case.
They're not a corporation in Texas. That's right.
So that doesn't pull in that piece of Tarrington. And there's no interest in the plaintiff's monetary recovery on the damages side here. And maybe liability to protect Texas citizens from product defects on the liability side. But in terms of analyzing the damages issue, it's hard for me to see where Texas has an interest in the plaintiffs here, compensatory damages, when they're not citizens.
I understand your point, and you can certainly argue there's a difference, but it goes back to my point. Why impose liability? There's no damage.
Would you agree that the law is you decide the law based on the question asked? I mean, you have to divide liability and damages.
You can't. I mean, in a Tarrington case, this court decided to use the Texas measure of damages, even though it was a North Carolina plaintiff. And of course, maybe the argument was that the parties had agreed to liability as to Texas. But that same argument would apply here. I mean, if Texas law should apply as to liability, it makes sense to incorporate the entire state. Because what good is it going to say, you have a defective product, we're going to impose liability, but you can go because there's no damages, there's no consequence.
Well, then the language in Tarrington would just be surplusage that I just quoted. The language I just quoted from Tarrington would have no effect. I mean, the way you've just interpreted that language would overrule the Wagner-Brown, Horwood, I can't remember the name of the case. It said you have to look at the issues differently, the choice of law, according to the issue you're analyzing. Liability, damages.
Right. And you do that. And you can also consider that what is the effect of finding, looking at different interests. The interest in Texas is one, ensuring there's a product liability scheme, without which, if there's no damages, there is no scheme. There's an interest in Mexico is making sure their residents receive adequate compensation under their system.
Why wouldn't Mexico have an interest in the sale since this particular resale occurred in Mexico?
That's probably a factor they might, but it's not one of the factors I think listed in the restatement. The restatement really talks about the initial sale, not subsequent sales. I mean, the conduct described in the restatement suggests those three factors I mentioned earlier, design, manufacture, and stream of commerce. Once it's in the stream of commerce, then it can go anywhere, and it's already a product claim out of that first state. I think as this court said in the Armstrong case...
Do you always go back to the state where a product was sold in the first place, and that's the state with the most significant relationship?
No, it's one of the factors you consider. And that's why you went to the other situation about going into the dealership. Let me address the second issue, if the court had any other questions on that. That's the issue of whether or not separately submitted claimants can be added together. Honda asserts there's two theories why this court can do. One is Honda claims that the Civil Practice of Remedies Code 33011 says you can do it. Of course, nothing in the Civil Practice of Remedies Code says you can combine separately submitted claimants. In fact, no case law has ever been cited to this court in which claimants who have been submitted separately have been combined. In fact, the only case that really addresses it is probably the Haney Electric case, which is the basis of the pattern jury charge, and it's the basis of the charge that is submitted in this case. I think as the court pointed out, the way to resolve it is if you believed that claimants was in fact one claimant, you have an obligation to submit it, claimants, Honda, and some. That wasn't done in the case. Once you separate it, there has to be some authority for the court to go back and combine it. There's none. Nothing in the statute suggests that was the intent when they drafted 33011. Even Senator Montford's article, which is cited as authority for this particular issue, in Montford's article, he doesn't cite any statements of legislative intent by legislatures during the legislature.
Let me ask you, I understand you're talking about Montford, but I'm trying to figure out how that would work. How would a child, is run over in the street and both parents and three cousins and brothers and sisters are all standing there right at the time it happens. How is any of their negligence the same negligence as the person standing next to them? The event, the activity they might be in would be the same, but it would seem to be the infinite variety of reasons. Or my back was turned, or I was in a conversation, or I thought Sam had the child, or I thought Brenda had the child. It's hard for me to envision a scenario where any individual who has been asserted to be negligent could have been identical to any other individual, such that you would say, well, I want to list all these people as one people, and I want the jury to say, what was their negligence, one blank? I mean, it seemed to me that you couldn't, it would be virtually impossible for the jury to answer that question without, in fact, having to add together, determining what the individual liability of each of these individual culpability of these people together, and then coming, the number will necessarily be a sum of individual numbers.
And certainly if you submit it as a single entity, that would probably have to happen in some form. But the problem is, as you point out, first, if the individuals have no connection, you can't submit them together. The reason Honda argues these people should be submitted is two reasons. One is they're claimants under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and they should be initially submitted as one claimant. Or secondly, their parents, and they have a joint responsibility to supervise the child. There are some cases cited regarding joint supervision. But none of those cases, one, say that you can join parents if you're submitted as separate. You know, it just hasn't been done. This would be the first time it gets done. The second thing is the facts of this case don't support joint supervision. The facts of this case are unique, are very different as to the father and the mother. The testimony in this case is the son asked his father for an ATV. The testimony in this case is the father, after being asked that, decided to start research. He looked at different kinds. He got some information on it. Then he decided to go to Brownsville Sports Center as part of this process. Gone there on two occasions. After he finally was satisfied with what to get, the father went out and bought it. After the father got it, he took it and put his son on it and trained him for a year and a half. The mother wasn't involved. The father bought a helmet and instructed him to wear it. The father, at the one time he didn't have the helmet on, punished him for doing it.
But the jury awarded the same negligence.
I'm sorry?
The jury awarded the same negligence, so they didn't quite see it that way.
And what happens if the jury awarded $10.50? Do we evaluate it differently? Of course not. It has to be, I mean, the jury award could have come out anyway. What if the jury award is zero and 60? Can we add them together? They would have made the same argument regardless of what the jury award was. So the jury award can't determine it. It has to be done before the submission first. If you do it afterwards, then you have to come up with some new rule why you can do it. You have to argue to the trial court, this is a joint supervisory situation. The plaintiffs are one entity. We're going to submit them as a single plaintiff.
Again, my same question raised to Mr. Holman. Shouldn't the judge know beforehand what your position is? Because neither one of you at base argued that it's absolute. You argue that there's a fact-based rationale behind whether or not you're going to aggregate different people's conduct. But based on what the particular facts of the case show.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The way this charge goes, particularly with pattern jury charge, talking about sometimes separate, sometimes the same, the trial judge isn't going to know what you have in mind until after the jury verdict comes back and people start arguing for entry of judgment.
And that's the point, Your Honor. The Drillick's opinion wasn't that. There was no authority to suggest you would combine plaintiffs at the time. And it wasn't argued. So the pattern jury charge, jury charge that was submitted was essentially the same as in Haney Electric. And it's discussed in the pattern jury charge, and it says, this may not be the best one, but we can figure out how to interpret it, and that's what the Court of Appeals did.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Please, the Court. I'd like to address just a few issues briefly. One, they say that you should consider the fact that Mr. Ramos visited the Brownsville dealership. Even the Court of Appeals said that that was irrelevant. The reason it's irrelevant is because he said, when asked, had you decided after you left the Brownsville dealership to buy a Honda? He said, no, I bought the Honda because my friend, my brother's compadre had it. And I would have, if he'd had a Yamaha, I would have bought the same thing. That's in the record at volume 8, page 105. Secondly, they say that there is no Mexican defendant here. There is no Texas defendant here. There are no interests to protect defendants in this case. Justice O'Neill asked about who has the most interest in plaintiff's recovery. Of course, that is Mexico. Texas has no interest in the plaintiff's recovery in this case. There's no contacts with Texas. There is a restatement presumption, restatement of torts, section 178, that says in wrongful death case, the presumption is that the damages, that the law that will govern damages in wrongful death case is the law of the forum where the wrongful death took place and the plaintiff suffered their injury.
Is it in the record whether or not Honda does business in Mexico? Does it have a dealership in Mexico?
Yes, they do business in Mexico. And it is in the record. It's in the record. The motion to apply the substantive law of Mexico is found in clerk's record 150, page 150. And in that, they go through an analysis of all the contacts that Honda has elsewhere. And one of the things that they mention is that Honda does have a organization in Mexico.
Was the Brownsville dealer considered the Van Morris dealer as well?
He doesn't have any agency in Matamoros. The Brownsville dealer is the agent for the Texas area. But I don't. I think that Mexico. I don't know. With regard to the Haney Electric Company, of course, that case that can't apply because that case was decided before the statute, and it never interpreted what the meaning of this statute is. This court has interpreted the meaning of that statute. General Chemical Corporation versus De La Lastra, dealing with 41011, which is the same definition of claimant, the court said in that case that claimant means not only the deceased, but all persons, plural, that are seeking recovery on behalf of the deceased. In Trilax, this court said that claimant means all the members of the family, not just one claimant, not separate claimants. Now, does this make sense? Yes, it makes sense. The Code Construction Act says that when we're construing the code, singular means plural. Plural means singular. So you should consider that they mean everybody that's suing on behalf of the person. Now, if Drillex is the law and it continues to be the law, then Drillex itself was applied after the jury entered its verdict. The Drillex interpretation of how you apply the jury findings is how Drillex applied that rationale to the jury findings. Here, too, we applied the statute after the jury entered its findings. It's how you apply the law to the jury's findings. And that's what Drillex stood for. That's what this case should stand. Dealing with 410011, which is the same definition of claimant, the court said in that case that claimant means not only the deceased, but all persons, plural, that are seeking recovery on behalf of the deceased. In Trilax, this court said that claimant means all the members of the family, not just one claimant, not separate claimants. Now, does this make sense? Yes, it makes sense. The Code Construction Act says that when we're construing the code, singular means plural. Plural means singular. So you should consider that they mean everybody that's suing on behalf of the person. Now, if Drillex is the law and continues to be the law, then Drillex itself was applied after the jury entered its verdict. The Drillex interpretation of how you apply the jury findings is how Drillex applied that rationale to the jury findings. Here, too, we applied the statute after the jury entered its findings. It's how you apply the law to the jury's findings. And that's what Drillex stood for. That's what this case should stand for. Finally, they say that you should consider that there are different facts with regard to the father and the mother. And I could go in and I could point out to you all the facts that had to do with the mother. The mother said that she bought the helmet. The mother rode on the vehicle herself. The mother knew that he was riding unsupervised, knew that he rode into town, knew that sometimes he didn't wear a helmet. But all that stuff's irrelevant. The jury found, I see my time is up, man. I have a moment to conclude.
Anybody want to hear the conclusion? I guess we'll get it from the brief.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
That concludes the argument in the second cause. The court will now take another brief recess.
All right.